This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The University of Central Florida has been rocked by controversy in recent months over construction spending. The fallout from misspending of state money on Trevor Colburn Hall led to the resignation of President Dale Whitaker and the firing of a number of UCF employees. Now, Interim President Thad Seymour says the university is working to put the controversy in the rearview mirror and focus on projects like opening the downtown campus, bolstering research, and hiring a new president. Well, Thad Seymour is the Interim President of the University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Matthew.
This is a prestigious job, and I know that not too long ago the board voted to extend your tenure, essentially, in this interim role. What have you learned about this job and the challenges of it in the short time that you've been in this position?
Well, first of all, it's an honor to serve in this role. I knew before, but have firsthand knowledge now of the breadth and the strengths of the university and the number of things we're involved in that really have an impact on the region. One of the things that has been most fun has been to spend a lot of time with students. And it's a great reminder every day that that's why we exist and that we continue to do everything we can to create amazing experiences for them as they go out into the workforce.
You're coming into this, it's kind of a turbulent time for the university, right? There's a lot of scrutiny on construction particularly. I'm sure it's probably not the best circumstances that you would necessarily pick to come into this role, but are there some advantages to at least having some insight into some of the projects that the university has got going on construction-wise before stepping into it?
Yeah, it has been a challenging time for UCF, but it is also, in the long span of things, a short period of time. I'm a historian by training, and I think in terms of the long term. And so what we're focused on is improving some of those areas that we learned we could do better. And we're making great headway on that. Many of those changes and improvements began last fall after the discovery of some of the challenges we had, but they continue. And I look at this next year as a chance to really strengthen the university in ways that we might not have otherwise had this not happened.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those things that the university does need to do better?
Well, one of those is to strengthen our financial operations. And to that end, we have just announced the addition of a new interim CFO who will join us in early May. There's a strong team there, but there are things we want to continue to improve. Again, many of those processes have been put in place, but there are others that we want to implement. We identified the need to train our board members and our senior leadership and our board of governors in new ways about the financial complexities of a big university and the university system. And so we've got a lot of initiatives underway that are going to improve that very quickly.
Do you think the university was treated unfairly, or some of the criticisms leveled at the university over the construction of the academic building were unfair?
I don't know. It's been a hard number of months and challenging for people at the university and people in the community. I'm focused on looking forward and how do we build on that? And sometimes painful episodes can turn into good, and that's really where we're putting our energy and I think to a good end.
Is this a job you want long term?
This is going to be a great job for somebody. I'm at a stage in my career where I'm going to do everything I can to continue to move the university forward over the next year. But the Board of Trustees will launch a search process in the fall, with the hope of selecting the next president in late winter, early spring, who would start next summer. And my job is to have the university in the best shape possible to both help attract the best candidate and then to hand the baton off to the long-distance runner.
And at this stage, you're not putting your name in the hat?
That's correct.
I'm wondering, though, if you could talk a little bit about the downtown campus. And I'm wondering, too, if what's happened at the university in recent months will have any impact on the opening of downtown campus, the way that project rolls out?
Yeah, no impact at all. I'm really excited about this project and have been for several years. It will open on August 26th. Our first class is at 7 a.m. that day. I even have an app on my phone with a day, an hour, and minute counter. All things are coming together to be ready for that. The most important thing is it's going to create this presence downtown with almost 8,000 students, faculty, staff from both UCF and Valencia, who will have a chance to think about and experience the entire downtown as their campus. And so certainly they'll take classes on campus, but have all kinds of internship opportunities within walking distance or Lime bike or limo ride away. And we have for years and increasingly focused on graduating students who just haven't had classroom experience, but who have actually worked in the areas of their interest so that when they go into the workforce, they have that experience to build on. And that's what employers tell us they want, and that's what students know that they want. And this gives us an incredible opportunity to do that really well.
So going back to your point you made at the start of our conversation about growth and how you're saying that you can be a big university and a great university, I think that's what you said, mm-hmm. or something along those lines. Is there a certain point at which you have to say, okay, that's enough, we can't take more students, or we have to sort of set a limit because at a certain point it's going to become too big?
Yeah, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, universities might have said that. I don't think that's true anymore, whether it's technology or physical space or different ways of continuing to grow. But we are big already. We have achieved scale. And the pace at which we grow in the future will determine over time. It will be slower, I believe, over the next few years. And while we may slow our growth, we're going to double down on the excellence that we provide. So our strategic plan is built on this idea of scale times excellence equals impact. And if it is about how do we maximize our impact on our region, on our society, on our economy, and beyond certainly our region, the excellence piece really makes a huge difference. And so that will be our next wave of ongoing investments to really expand that.
What does that actually mean, though? I mean, because that sounds like an interesting kind of sum, if you will, but what does that mean practically?
Yeah, so it starts with, in a university setting, starts with great faculty. The faculty are the drivers of that student experience, and they are attracting the best possible faculty, developing those who are here. It enhances the classroom experience, which means the talent we deliver to society is even stronger. It also means that we drive further ahead in building our reputation as a great research university. Universities are their role in our world is to deliver talent and ideas to society, and the research engine drives those new ideas. Mm-hmm. And so if we do that well and some of those spin out into new companies or new product ideas that ultimately create new jobs and wealth creation and value, that's all part of the formula of how a research university of high quality drives a region. And we can look at any great city in this country and, in fact, in the world through history, and they have been anchored by great research universities.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Thad Seymour. He's the interim president of UCF. So what does that mean for the kinds of courses you are going to be focusing resources on, or the kinds of academic tracks? And I'm wondering how the arts fits into all of this. Because if you say research, are you talking about scientific research or medical research in particular, or engineering?
We do research across every single discipline. They take different forms. They're different. It's different in the arts, in other humanities, in the hard sciences. It takes a lot of different forms. Some of those drive a lot of external research dollars. Others do less of that but drive the state of the art of that particular academic discipline. Mm-hmm. And so a great research university has to be broad-based and has to provide that kind of breadth of program offerings. Having said that, great universities also need to be tuned to the economic and societal needs of their region. We have a unique role in a fast-growing region. You go into a Midwestern Rust Belt city where demographics are going in the other direction. Mm-hmm. We have to be a key driver of that growth and contributor to that growth. One of the reasons we have grown so much in the last few years. But we need to tune that to those industries that we want to grow here. And I've spent a lot of time over the last decade and more focused on those innovation economies, often tech-based, which tend to include higher wage jobs, mm-hmm. More value creation, real economic drivers. And so what we produce, both in our talent and those innovative ideas, need to contribute to that and align with where we want to go.
What about the medical city and all of that?
Yeah, and that's a great example. So one of the things I had begun to work on last year and will continue in the coming years is focusing our efforts on three what we call commonly innovation districts. Mm-hmm. And one of those is Lake Nona, which is really built around health and life sciences innovation. A second one is Research Park, one of the great examples of a research park adjacent to a large, impactful university. Mm-hmm. And the third will be downtown. So one of the roles of the downtown campus will be a catalyst for innovation and imagine companies and new job creation, whether it's in digital media or game development or smart city applications, right, embedded in the downtown. So each of those three, including Lake Nona's Medical City, are going to be key enablers of this economic diversification for the region. And the university has made big bets on each of those, and we're going to continue to invest there.
Okay, so where does the arts fit into that? Like somebody who would be graduating with a degree like yours, like a history degree, how do they fit into this sort of new direction for the university or this expansion of what you're doing already?
Well, first of all, great cities also embrace the arts, and that's a huge part of the quality of life in a great 20th, 21st century community and region. And so we have a responsibility to do that. But we also know we're going to graduate talented people who may start out in one path, but over time move into different kinds of career trajectories. A few years ago, I gave a commencement speech, and I described the idea that reflected my experience, which was to celebrate the crooked path, which means build on what you learn, but don't be constrained by that. And your career may take you in a lot of different directions. For me, as a history major and ultimately a PhD in history, it was the ability to synthesize ideas and communicate in written form and put things into perspective. And I've applied that in real estate development and technology companies and now in a university setting. And so I think if we're producing graduates who have the tools in a fast-paced economy that's evolving, they're going to find the path where they can make the most impact.
Let me just come back to the leadership position you're in now and some of the challenges. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the politics of it, because part of the, I guess, the issue and the scrutiny on the university, and not just UCF, but other colleges and universities now, is obviously around how building funds are spent. How do you negotiate some of those kind of political challenges and like what do you tell lawmakers to reassure them that UCF and if it's not the school, other schools are doing the right thing?
Well, it is about trust and then it's about process and all of that really has to be built on the foundation that we are educating large numbers of students very heavily with public funds, mm-hmm. and the funds of those families who are paying for their children's education. So every university has a responsibility to use every dollar in the right way. And so when you deviate from that, even with the best of intentions, you have to make the corrections to prevent that from happening again. And again, we're doing that. I think it's caused introspection for all the universities and the overall state university system. And I just see already we're going to be better because of this. And we didn't want to go through this. Nobody did. Mm-hmm. But it happened. And the question now is how do we make ourselves better? And that's what we're focused on.
I do have to ask you, too. There was an Orlando Sentinel article published a month or two back, and a researcher they talked to called the payout to your predecessor, Dale Whitaker, of $600,000 or so, overly generous. I'm wondering what your perspective on that is. Was that overly generous? Did the university make a bad call there?
I don't really have an opinion. I think it was a decision made by the Board of Trustees and consultation with many others. And you can make arguments in lots of different directions. But I think it was very important that be handled well and that we were able to move on. And this is that has allowed us to do that.
Mm-hmm. And back to your comment earlier about the team of leaders that you have at the university. Have they been rattled a little bit by what's happened in the last 6 months?
Yeah, I think for a while all of us were. This was hard. This involved people we worked with and respected and had and were friends with. And it certainly, you never want the place that you work and the place that you care about to appear on the front page of the newspapers or in the media in negative light.
Sure.
So consistently. On the other hand, I think now that we have moved, we are moving past that, people have very quickly gone back to the roots of why they care about this university so much and why we work hard to do what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so that is helping people deal with that and now stay focused on where do we head in the future.
A year down the track, if you are not the president of UCF, what do you think you'll be doing at UCF?
Well, I tried to retire 4 years ago, and as many of my friends and my wife have reminded me, I have completely failed and have been going in the wrong direction. So I may give it another try. We'll see what happens.
Well, Thad Seymour, Interim President of the University of Central Florida, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew. Enjoyed it.
Still to come on Intersection, SpaceX is figuring out what went wrong during testing on its Crew Dragon capsule. A conversation about getting a new generation of astronauts into orbit safely when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A few weeks ago, SpaceX was testing the engines on its Crew Dragon, the capsule designed to carry astronauts into orbit, when something went wrong. The mishap sent a plume of smoke billowing over Cape Canaveral and speculation about the commercial crew program swirling. So what's changed in 5 decades of testing spacecraft, and what does this anomaly mean for NASA's partnership with SpaceX and Boeing? For more, we're joined by Brendan Byrne and Amy Foster. Brendan Byrne, 90.7 Space Reporter, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
I'm also joined by Amy Foster. She is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida. Amy, thanks so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
So Brendan, just get us caught up to speed on the latest on SpaceX's investigation into the anomaly when they were doing the static firing of the engines on that SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule.
Yeah, not much is known still, as the investigation still ongoing, and NASA and SpaceX have both been tight-lipped on this as they continue the investigation. But we know a few more things. They were, as you mentioned, they were testing the Super Draco engines on the capsule, which will pull the capsule away to safety should there be a problem during flight. And that's when we saw photos of black smoke and different colored smoke leaving the testing facility at Cape Canaveral. And an unofficial video that we haven't been able to, you know, get confirmation on shows the capsule pretty much exploding.
It's pretty catastrophic, right?
It looks very catastrophic. But right now, SpaceX is saying it's a mishap, which is a standard word that they use for, you know, an accident that doesn't involve the loss of human life. No one was injured. And a safety panel said, you know, they did everything that they were supposed to do in the event of an emergency or an anomaly during testing. So there's no concerns for any safety issues. This system in particular, the abort system on the commercial crew capsule. So there's the SpaceX Crew Dragon that we've been talking about. There's also Boeing CST Starliner. Mm-hmm. And they both have this kind of new abort system. And this is a push abort system. So these are engines that are actually on the capsule that will push the capsule away from the rocket booster if there's an issue. Historically, rockets have used a pull system. So that's the tower that's on the top of the capsule that you see on the Russian Soyuz or mm-hmm. the future NASA SLS or on the Mercury capsule. And basically, if there was an issue, that motor would fire above the capsule and pull it away. SpaceX and Boeing went with this push method because it could save a little bit of money. These engines can use the same fuel that you would need for, you know, reaction control thrusters or to maneuver through space. So if you're using the same fuel, then, you know, you can save some money. And also they want to reuse these capsules. So usually with a pull system, the older version, you would jettison that at some point during the launch and it would be gone. Mm-hmm. With these engines, you can reuse them theoretically.
Has this incident had any effect on the schedule for cargo launches or for, I guess, the human-rated crew capsule as well?
Well, no effect on the cargo launches. Whether or not this affects the human launches, the commercial crew launches, that's still unclear. You would think that there would be because of figuring out what happened, but there has been no official announcement of that. SpaceX was targeting July. That essentially is probably not going to happen for the first human launch. They still need to perform an in-flight abort test. They have to test this system on a rocket that has launched. And essentially, they were going to use the capsule that exploded for that test. So it's unclear what capsule they're going to use for the in-flight abort test, which surely will add to the delays as well.
Right. Well, Amy Foster, give us a bit of historical context. I mean, early space flight, the Mercury program, the Apollo program, there were some testing mishaps, right? So how does this sort of fit into the continuum of testing the hardware designed to get people into space?
NASA has certainly been testing rockets, testing capsules, testing engines since 1958 when NASA was founded. So there's a long history there. I think this accident is most reminiscent for me to Apollo 1, which unfortunately did result in the loss of three lives. But I think when we look at the investigation of what happened there, Chris Kraft, who was one of the flight directors for NASA for years and eventually became the director of Johnson Space Center, noted that if that accident had happened in space, we might not have gotten to the moon by the end of the decade. The fact that it happened on the ground meant everything that went wrong was accessible, so that engineers could take that capsule apart and figure out exactly what went wrong. And so in that sense, there's a positive to this accident happening how it happened, that SpaceX and NASA have access to all of the equipment to pick it apart. But because we're putting humans in space on these vehicles, NASA certainly takes safety very seriously, as seriously as they can. And so, you know, SpaceX is doing what they need to do in making sure that they understand what's going on. The one thing that I find really kind of fascinating about the space program is every element that can be tested is tested. What was unusual is when NASA launched the space shuttle for the first time. So STS-1 was the first test of that entire rocket stack put together, and two people were on board.
Wow.
And that was extraordinary. And, you know, from a historical standpoint, that's something that NASA would never do, except the shuttle couldn't fly itself. Everything else they could test unmanned at some level and just watch it work. And the shuttle wasn't that way. And so STS-1 was really a historically different kind of experience for NASA.
And I guess NASA, they were at pains to stress that after the loss of lives with, you know, Challenger and Columbia, they sort of stress, you know, every single launch is essentially an experiment, right?
Absolutely. You know, when we're talking about vehicles, unlike the vehicles that we drive every day that are produced on an assembly line with parts that come off the shelves, these aren't that. These are hand-pieced artifacts, essentially. You know, there are parts that come off the shelf, but, you know, when we're talking about the space shuttle orbiters, there were five.
Right.
That's it. You don't build an assembly line for something like that. So these are highly crafted, highly complex machines that you then strap a bunch of fuel on top. And as John Glenn always said, you know, I'm on top of the rocket built by, you know, the lowest bidding contractors, you know, and it is essentially a candle that you're, well, a stick of dynamite that you're going to light and sit on top of. And there's risk in that.
If you extrapolate that out to what's happening now with the commercial crew program, is there more of an assembly line approach with these capsules than there was for the shuttle, or some differences, obviously, because we're talking about different spacecraft?
I think long term, yes. I mean, that's something that is a goal. We do want to make spaceflight accessible. We want to make it profitable. I don't know that that's going to happen in the lifetimes of those of us sitting here. But it is a long-term goal. And that doesn't surprise me. I think that's just kind of human nature for always pushing toward that next frontier, which for us is space. So making vehicles essentially that can come off an assembly line, it's a future. That's a goal. But it's a long-term goal. And right now, everything is still very much in a test phase, and it will be for a while.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Associate Professor of History at UCF, Amy Foster, and 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne, talking about the way ahead for SpaceX after the mishap with its Crew Dragon capsule. Brendan, what about that push and pull between profitability and safety, and what are you hearing about the plan for SpaceX and how it works through some of these testing issues?
I think what's really important to note is the way SpaceX does development. It's a lot different than a lot of other engineering or aerospace engineering companies that have come before it. And that's what a lot of people have said is the reason for it being such an innovative company, is it tests as it moves forward. So, you know, landing the booster, that was a game-changing engineering feat that company was able to pull off.
Still pretty miraculous.
It's incredible to see. It's absolutely incredible to see it, you know, 20-story tall, you know, booster falling out of the sky and perfectly landing where it's supposed to go. But those landings are still considered experimental. They are learning as they go along. They didn't send up a bunch of test articles and try to land that booster. No, the first booster that landed was a part of a mission, mm-hmm. And they just, you know, added on to that. And
kind of like what Amy was saying about the shuttle.
Exactly. You kind of learn as you go. And that's really important to make that distinction with SpaceX. This is how they operate. This is built into, you know, their engineering plans. They expect these things to happen, and then they work through them. And I think that's a really important point to say. Another thing I think we need to mention is that this is not the first, you know, abort engine issue with commercial crew. Last year, Boeing had an issue with a static fire of their engine. It was leaking those toxic fuels. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like that right now, that pinch point in commercial crew is this abort system. Both companies still have not done their in-flight abort tests. They're still waiting for that critical milestone. So, you know, I think it's important to mention that Boeing is struggling with these abort motors as well.
Amy, what is it like as a historian and sort of thinking back to everything that's gone before with NASA's Apollo program, the Mercury program, everything else, and what's happening now with commercial crews, sort of seeing this stuff happen before your very eyes? What is that feeling like?
It's exciting. We're watching history in the making. I recently participated in a program where we were talking publicly about science, and a question got asked about this transition to commercial spaceflight and whether this would work. And I said, as a historian, I can say we have a model for that. We have to go back to aviation, which, you know, we've been flying airplanes technically since 1903. So mm-hmm. We've had a little bit of experience with that. But aviation really developed thanks to government support. We had the NACA founded, which was the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, which provided a lot of funding and a lot of scientific support for the development of aircraft. And then as it becomes an opportunity for profit, you start to get airlines develop. And that's when you get this transition really from government control to private ownership of corporations. And there's a lot of growing pains in that process when you take it out of that government oversight, which is willing to spend money to insist on safety mm-hmm. and not really push boundaries. And you give that into the hands of people who ultimately have to make a profit. You do have to push those boundaries a little bit more. It kind of goes back to this idea of routine spaceflight. We've come to expect that we're going to launch a rocket with people on top and it's going to work and nothing's going to happen. And when something happens, people are just stunned and shocked and they don't understand why, mm-hmm. because it's still risky. But I think and certainly when we moved from aviation being so government controlled to private ownership, we did see more accidents. And the sad part, I think, of this transition to commercial spaceflight is that is something that's going to happen. We're not going to see accidents on a daily basis, and they're not going to happen. You know, you're not going to turn on the news and see another one happening and more deaths. But we do turn on the news with some regularity and see a major aircraft disaster.
Right.
That's going to happen with spaceflight. And I think it's going to take some growth and acceptance that this is part of technological development. There are failures, and sometimes they're horrific, but it is part of that growth too.
And I guess the astronauts who are signing up for this challenge are fully aware of all of the potential things that could go wrong when they strap into whatever spacecraft they're testing.
I think if there's anybody on this planet who understands the risks more than anybody, it is the astronauts. But they do this for passion and they do this for love. They are extraordinarily excited about this opportunity. And they put their trust in the engineers. And so there is a close personal relationship. And I can tell you that when an accident happens and astronauts do die, the people who take it the hardest are the engineers.
The Orlando Sentinel editorial board called out NASA and SpaceX for not providing enough transparency during the investigation into the mishap with the Crew Dragon capsule. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think in this day and age, you know, it's something that we demand. You know, we want transparency. We want transparency in everything. I don't think it's that simple. And I think the fact of the matter is NASA and SpaceX probably don't have many answers at this point. Mm-hmm. As Brendan said, these engines they are pieces of art. They are complex pieces of machinery and
terrifying pieces of art.
Yes, with hundreds of thousands of parts. And it's possible that, to go back to Apollo 1, it was one frayed wire. It was one frayed wire that now was burned. So, you know, tracing back to what the problem was, what is at fault, is going to take time.
Well, Amy Foster is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Brendan Byrne, 90.7 Space Reporter. Brendan, thanks as well.
Happy to be here.
Up next, T. Kara Madden and Kristen Arnett on growing up in Florida and what it means to be a queer writer in the Sunshine State. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Growing up in Boca Raton, T. Kara Madden experienced what she describes as cult-like privilege, racial disparities, and rampant white-collar crime. Madden's father built a shoe empire along with her uncle, Steve Madden, and worked for Jordan Belfort, whose Wall Street excesses were dramatized in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. In her new memoir, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls, Madden writes about the challenge of coming of age as queer and biracial in Boca Raton as her parents grappled with drug and alcohol addiction. Madden will read from her memoir at Rice's Block Bookstore in Winter Park this Wednesday. She'll be joined in conversation by Orlando-based queer writer Kristen Arnett, whose forthcoming debut novel about a taxidermist is titled Mostly Dead Things. I spoke to Madden and Arnett about their writing. Madden began the conversation.
My book is a coming-of-age memoir growing up in Boca Raton, Florida, in a biracial mixed family as a queer girl in a very privileged community. There are plenty of family secrets, lots of family drama, as I'm sure many of us can relate to. And I'm so excited to be coming through Florida. Kristen is one of my favorite authors in the world. I'm so excited for her book. And I'll be really excited to read with her and chat with her.
So is this like a kind of a homecoming for you? Do you spend much time at all in Florida now, T. Kara?
I come home a few times a year. My family is still in Florida. My sister is there. So I am actually on my way down right now. I'm driving from Maine to Florida and making a few stops all around. So it does feel like the last leg of the tour and kind of the homecoming tour.
And Kristen, tell me about your book. This is your debut novel,
correct? It is, yes. The book, it's called Mostly Dead Things. And as you can maybe tell from the title, it is about taxidermy, but it's also it's a story about a young lesbian woman who has to take over her family's taxidermy business in Central Florida after her father commits suicide. And it's also a family book, much like T. Kara's book, where it's looking at the dynamics of family and what it means to try and take care of your family when you feel maybe kind of incapable of doing that.
Why taxidermy?
First of all, it's just very gross and interesting to me. I also think there's a lot of taxidermy around in Florida. I mean, in the South, even, maybe. I grew up around a ton of it. Like, you go into friends' houses, or I remember even growing up in the church where we had, there were, like, deer mounts all over the wall. So it was something that I grew up seeing all the time and not necessarily thinking about, just kind of was around me. Mm-hmm. And I'm also very interested in the body and the physicality of things. So the idea of kind of being hands-on within the book and using taxidermy as this kind of focus to show how we want to be able to pose things and have things happen seemed exactly right for me to write about.
How do you go about doing research for a book like this? Did you want to immerse yourself in everything there is to know about taxidermy? Like, did you talk to taxidermists to learn a little bit about the craft yourself?
Yeah, the short answer to that is yes. The longer-ish answer is that, yeah, I did a ton of research up front. I ordered a lot of books, a lot of taxidermy manuals, the breakthrough manuals. I watched a lot of videos online. You'd be shocked how many YouTube videos you can find about, like, people actually taxiderming an animal. Also a lot of, like, chat forums and web forums where people kind of shared tips and tricks with each other. Mm-hmm. Pun intended, like hacks.
Life hacks for the taxidermist. Yeah.
But yeah, I spent a lot of time looking into it because I wanted to make sure it seemed authentic. And also I was just very interested in it and wanted to know like the actual kind of physical toll it would take on a person, like what you have to do to be able to manipulate flesh like that.
And it's a niche, right? I mean, there can't be too many novels out there about taxidermists.
There are some. I'm interested in reading all of them. So,
well, T. Kara, in your upbringing, I'm wondering, did you spend a lot of time in houses with deer heads on the walls and other things like that? A lot of taxidermy around in your neck of the woods?
I did, actually. And I was raised with my mother's side of the family is Chinese and Buddhist, and they believe in reincarnation. And my great-grandmother told me that any animal I see is another human being. So I remember very distinctly going to friends' homes with taxidermy and wondering who was whom in my family spying on me.
Wow.
It kind of spooked me growing up.
That sounds unsettling.
Yes.
So tell me more about the memoir. There's a lot going on here. How tough was it to condense that all into a book and put it all out there?
Yeah, there is a lot. It does cover a lot. It's been kind of the joke of the book since its inception and since it was sold, was that there's no way to really describe it. It's more of an experience. It's a three-act story, and the first act covers my childhood, the second act kind of teenage coming of age years, and the third act is actually in the present. And the third act came later as I made these family discoveries while I was writing the book and finishing the book. After my father died, I made some discoveries about our history that kind of reframed the entire book. So I wrote all of that after the book had sold. So it's kind of an interesting lens that reshapes and recolors the rest of the book once you get to that final section. But it does. It covers everything from sexuality to the racial dynamics in Boca Raton, Florida, to crime. My family was investigated in a pretty famous The Wolf of Wall Street crime with Jordan Belfort. And just girlhood, coming of age in a body. I'm also interested in the body, and I think that's all over my book and what that means.
Did you always know you were going to be a writer, T. Kara? Did you keep journals when you were younger? Did you write creatively in school and things?
I did. I kept so many journals. I wrote a series of books when I was a kid. It's called The Autobiography of Joni Baloney, and she was kind of this projection of myself or the self I wish I had her life. So she would be in the same situations as me and sort of be bullied in the same ways, but she would find her ways out, and she did ultimately escape in the series and join a circus, and she became a high dive board equestrian jumper. So she would jump into the pools of water. And that's kind of the life I wanted. And I wrote this whole series on this electric IBM typewriter, and I still use the same typewriter. And I think that was always a hope. I always wanted to be an artist of some kind. I left writing for a while. I went to school for design. I was in fashion design for many years. But I came back to writing, and I think it's all about narrative. It's all about
expression of story. That's always been my interest.
Joni Baloney sounds like a pretty good read. Have you pitched it? Like, could you return to that and could we see that in publication sometime?
Maybe I will. I haven't thought about it.
And it's interesting you mentioned the escape route for the character in that, because I note here in your biographical notes you're an amateur magician, so some kind of parallels with the hero of your story there as well.
Yes, definitely.
Tell me more about magic.
Well, my father was a gambler, and he played poker in Las Vegas, so we left town a lot to go to Vegas and stay in the resorts, and I would try to stay in the casinos with him, but I would always be kicked out, of course. And my way out of this, that my mother found this solution that we could go to magic shops all day. And in the Vegas magic shops and the hotels and resorts, they kind of give you lessons, you buy the tricks, and then they take you in back and teach you how to do all of them. So I ended up taking magic classes in Vegas every time we were there, and then magic classes back home in Plantation, Florida. And it's still a big part of my life. It's something I don't talk about too much. I don't perform very much, but I'm always reading books on magic. I'm interested in the craft and the mechanics behind tricks, the designs of certain tricks, and I do approach writing and art the same way I approach magic. I'm always after that kind of moment of awe, and also after, you know, the behind the scenes look at what makes a great trick that seems so simple, mm-hmm. but that can still provoke such shock and this kind of wonder. I'm always after wonder. I think I approach the two skills the same way.
Not to get too meta, but I mean, a good book will do that, right? It'll immerse you in a world, and then at the end of it, you're like, how did the author do that?
Yes. Yes. That's always what I want. And when I read, as a reader, I'm always wondering, how did they do that? Those are the best moments for me.
Kristen, what about your path to writing? Were you an avid journal keeper in school?
I think much like Takira, like I spent a lot of time growing up writing different kinds of stories for myself. I want to read the Baloney books,
Joni
too.
Baloney.
Yeah, that sounds great. I spent a ton of time. I had a lot of journals. I had a lot of writing I did. I also grew up in a house where I didn't have a lot of space or time to myself. So I would have to, like, if I wanted to be alone, I'd have to lock myself in our one bathroom that we had in the house and try and, like, work in there. So I have, like, a little notepad sitting in the corner with a bunch of people banging on the door all the time trying to get me to open the door. And I found, like, I have all these, like, little journals where I wrote, like, little short stories, because even when I was young, I really liked the idea of these kind of pocket stories that seemed like just a little pop of fiction that you mm-hmm. could read, like, in, like, once a snack story, maybe I used to call them. So I spent a lot of time putting those together. And even when I went to library school and was doing library work, I obviously like being around books, and I love being around reading, and I love being around people who want to talk about writing and reading. So it was like this natural progression for me going into that, because I also love working with the public and working with people and mm-hmm. talking about writing and talking about books and finding that magic in it for other people as well as myself. So I think I've spent my whole life writing things, never necessarily thinking I feel lucky that people have wanted to read it, but maybe never ever thinking they'd be for anyone other than myself. Mm-hmm. So it's been lovely to be able to share them with people or have people respond when I write things. But yeah, for sure, just always writing something.
How do you write? Do you write? Because Takira was talking about the electric typewriter she still uses, and that obviously kind of helps with the craft of creating these works. What about you?
Yeah. Well, when I was young, I definitely had just the worst little spiral journals that I would write in. But usually now I'm on the computer all the time. Like if I'm at the library, I'm on a computer somewhere. So I try and find pockets of time to write. I write specifically in single space, which I love because it just feels like everything's crammed together, which is how I feel like my brain functions a lot of the time. So everything's Times New Roman, everything's single spaced, and then I have to remember to not have it single spaced if I give it to somebody else to look at, because my reader is always, I'll send him something and he's like, oh god, single space smashed up writing again.
Are there some fonts you can't abide? I know people sometimes have a problem with certain kinds of fonts.
Oh,
like, is there
wow.
some stuff you can't write in?
I think everybody has very specific feelings about fonts. I just always write in Times New Roman. I think other fonts are fine. I just sometimes I'll flip what I've written into another font because then I feel like I can catch things maybe I miss because since I normally write just in that one. Mm-hmm. But I know people are very write or die for certain fonts, and they'll get into fights about it because people care so much.
Mm-hmm. What, yeah. T. Kara, what's your font hill to die on?
I use Adobe Kazlon.
Wow, that's not what I'm familiar
with. It's a fancy downloadable font.
Let me ask, and this is a question for both of you, but T. Kara, I want to start with you. Who are you writing the book for? Do you have, like, are you writing it for, when you were writing it, were you thinking there are other people who may have had a similar experience growing up for themselves, and this is who I'm reaching out to? Tell me about the audience you have in mind for this book.
Yeah, I think I'm always really writing for outsiders and misfits, and that can be for a number of reasons. Anyone who hasn't quite found their place or has always looked for their people. And I think I'm looking for the book I wish I had growing up. I know that sounds kind of romantic, but I didn't understand addiction. I didn't understand what went on in my household because of so many layers of shame. And I found this ghost-written memoir, Drew Barrymore's story called Little Girl Lost. And that was my book that I kept with me everywhere because it was the first time I read about addiction. And I thought up until that point, it was only in my house, the things that I saw, the objects I saw, before I had the vocabulary for what that meant to be in a family of addicts who are good people but who are unwell. So I think I'm always writing for that person, just trying to find their understanding and to find their place.
Let me come back to you then, Kristen, and ask about the audience for your book. Do you set out with a reader in mind? Are you kind of thinking about that reader as you write?
Yeah, and I actually love how T. Kara said that, that it would be like romantic, the idea of like writing for that, for yourself, like the thing you've always wished that you could read or think about. I think about that a lot because growing up, I was always looking for these kind of queer books that were doing the things I was interested in, like how I felt or like how I saw myself. So I'd say like a lot of times I'm writing for anybody that's looking to read about queerness and how it functions like within a family. Queerness in a way that's not necessarily talking about the coming out process, but the everyday day-to-day dynamics of in a household and like what it means to be queer in a family or to be in Florida. I guess I'm also writing because Florida is so special to me and always is featured in my work. And so I'm writing for Floridians and queer people and anybody that's also very interested in how we look at things physically or in this kind of tactile way that sometimes can be seen as ugly. Because I think that to say that things are either ugly or beautiful is this like weird binary that's not true. Mm-hmm. So I like to look at like how we perceive what might traditionally be seen as ugly or gross or upsetting and how we can dig into that and expand and look and see how those things are myriad and mean so much more than those things. So I'm also looking for the reader that wants to experience that with me, that wants to dig in and kind of interrogate questions. And also, yeah, for myself looking like as a teenager looking for those kind of queer narratives. I'm writing for that person too, I think.
Well, T. Kara Madden is the author of the memoir Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we're also joined by Kristen Arnett. Her forthcoming novel is Mostly Dead Things. Thank you as well, Kristen.
Thank you so much.
And you can find a link with more details about the reading and T. Kara Madden's memoir and Kristen Arnett's novel at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. We're more than halfway through our Spring Silent Drive. Your support helps keep programs like Intersection on the air, bringing you conversations and insight into stories like the leadership reshuffle at UCF, analysis of what's happening with the commercial space race, and interviews with Florida authors like Kristen Arnett and T. Kara Madden. So renew your annual contribution, make an additional gift of support, or take that first step and become a sustaining member. Call 1-800-785-2020 or join online at wmfe.org/support. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.